And the family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, sometime around age 6 to 8, children begin to realize that their parents could die, and then they realize that they could die. Of course, this is terrifying for a child. So what happens to all that anxiety? For most, it goes underground, and it stays underground. Well, my guest on today's show, Dr. Irvin Yalom, well-known existential psychotherapist, author of many books, explores this topic in his new book called Staring at the Sun, Overcoming the Fear of Death, which he argues lives deep down inside of all of us. And if we can, in fact, face our death, then it can help us to live our lives more fully. Dr. Yalom is a professor emeritus at Stanford University, and he's best known probably for his first book called Existential Psychotherapy. He wrote some best-selling novels, including Love's Executioner and When Nietzsche Wept. And like I said, his current book is called Staring at the Sun, Overcoming Terror of Death. Irvin Yalom, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here with you.
And we're pleased to have you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, Irvin, you've always been on the forefront of existential psychotherapy, and this is a psychotherapy that looks at the big picture, life, its meaning, death. What is it about you, your character, your background that has you looking at such big things as a younger man? That's not typical of younger people.
Well, I'm a little unusual as a psychiatrist because, you know, I've had one has to go to a medical school, and before that one has to have a heavy scientific training in pre-medical school. But I've always had a parallel interest in the humanities and in literature, and read voraciously when I was a child, always wanting to be a writer, and read fiction. And I always had the feeling that when I was taught about the history of psychiatry and the history of psychotherapy, people started the 19th century, maybe with Freud and Jung, but I've always felt that really the really great psychologists have been around for 2,500 years or so, and they're the philosophers and the great novelists like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. So I've had that kind of a bent, and I've always felt that our field of psychotherapy, it was a loss for us to really ignore these thinkers. And yeah, these thinkers tended to deal with bigger questions, you know, with questions of the human condition, what we have to face in life.
Well, and it seems that in today's culture, we're doing that less and less.
Yes, and I think that's true.
So let me ask you, kind of half tongue-in-cheek, why is death a problem in the first place? I mean, my dog loves life like all dogs do, but death doesn't seem like that much of a problem for him. He's more interested in lunch than
more interested in lunch, but we don't know what's going on in his mind. However, you know, it's thought. I mean, there's no definite proof of this, but it's thought that we human beings tend to differ from other living forms, in that we have the gift, the treasure of self-awareness. We are aware of us being an I, us being self. Maybe there are some new experimentations with other mammals and other primates that they do have a sense of themselves as all, you know, pictures and having them look at themselves in mirrors and that type of thing. But we are aware of ourselves, and we also are blessed with the idea that, we have a life cycle, and that eventually we're going to perish. And every single living creature is hardwired to try to persist in their own being, you know, tries to avoid threats to their own self.
Yeah, we
And I think it's hardwired into us. We want to continue to be.
Irvin, let me ask you to speak more directly into the phone. We're not getting...
Sure. Yes, every living being wants to persist in its own being, and I think we do too. You know, I think at some level we all fear oblivion. We all fear being extinguished. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay, I'll speak up.
The late sociologist Ernest Becker, who wrote his seminal work, The Denial of Death, which I think should be essential reading for...
It's a fine book.
Probably all humans. He suggested that all of life is about managing death anxiety, especially religion, God, heaven, afterlife, all that. You agree?
I agree entirely. And of course, as I was saying before, he's not the first to say this. This goes back to the ancient Greeks. I cite a particular Greek philosopher I like very much named Epicurus, who felt he was a medical philosopher and felt that his job was to attend to human desire, to human misery. And he felt all human misery really had at its root death anxiety.
And you agree?
I agree with that.
Huh. We're talking with Dr. Irvin Yalom about death anxiety. His most recent book's called Staring at the Sun, Overcoming Terror of Death, and he argues that all of our anxiety is ultimately about death anxiety. The number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. You've said there's many commonplace situations that you think provoke death anxiety. For example,
well, you know, but let me just amend something I just said to you, because I think maybe I said that a little bit too strong. I think that we have a number of anxieties in any given situation. I mean, I just saw someone a few days ago who is anxious about things that are happening in her life right now, and anxious about things that have happened in her past, and in addition, you know, has anxieties about her own death. I think it's one of many kinds of anxieties, but it's a type of anxiety that physicians and therapists tend to overlook. So what I'm saying is I want to increase the sensibility of therapists and individuals to this source of anxiety. It's not the only source of anxiety, sure. But anyway, you were saying, what did you just say?
The everyday situations that provoke death anxiety.
Right. Well, you know, it's often very hard for people to get at that. It's often pretty buried. And in my own history, I was starting to write a book on these things, and I found it very difficult to get at this information from patients. So I embarked in maybe 10 years of working with patients who are facing death because they had an incurable disease of terminal cancer. At that time, I was working almost entirely with women with breast cancer, and of course, that situation has improved so much. We have so much better treatment. But at that point, it was a death sentence. So I worked a lot with people who were facing death and taught me a lot. But now, when I work with patients, I think I have much better ways of looking at this. If you look at dreams, at nightmares, for example, every nightmare is a dream about death anxiety that somehow escaped from our usual repression. People undergo a lot of anxiety about death when, for example, a friend or close relative dies. You know, grief. We have ways of working with grief where we look at loss, and we help the person let go of all the energy attached to that person over many months. But another aspect of grief is that it's a confrontation with their own death.
Right, right.
We have a serious illness. We have to go in for some kind of medical test, and suddenly we're flooded with anxiety that, you know, surprises us sometimes.
Well, I wonder if we could argue that, or even rationalize, that almost any anxiety is about death. I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
A dear friend of mine just had a child for the first time.
Right.
And she feels overwhelming maternal love and gratitude, and like all new parents, she feels overwhelming anxiety about her ability to care for the child, and will she harm the child? And we could go down the path, and which will ultimately lead to anxiety about whether the child will die or whether she will die, and you know, the child won't be protected. But is that necessarily where that goes? Can it be just
no,
what
I
it
think
is?
No, I think they probably, what I'm speaking of is death anxiety is much lower on the hierarchy of such a person who's really embarking on life.
Life, right.
I would say if someone embarking on life, then that would be much lower down on the priority. If you get down deeper and it's a very, very self-meditative person, you know, some important life event like that also, in addition to anything else, begins to remind them that they are entering a new era of life.
I'm curious about our culture and how we look at death. And with the advent of modern medicine, we've really been quite skilled at sanitizing death and avoiding it. We make it more invisible. You know, it used to be that death was happening to an uncle in the living room, and sure. Now the uncle goes away. And not only that, what do we spend, Irvin, billions of dollars on anti-aging?
Oh, yeah.
Products. So,
and not only that, look what we do with the bodies. You know, they're not buried in the near the home. They're not buried in the churchyard. They're buried far away, out of sight.
So, does that ultimately raise death anxiety?
Well, I think that's a manifestation of our desire to deny it.
Well,
two centuries ago, it was much harder to deny when death was so much, as you say, so much more present. You know, it was very common that families lost some child to a young disease of childhood. So death was in the families, and people visited churchyards more frequently.
So
but now it's more sanitized.
What is the implication of having death sanitized the way it is? What impact does that have on our death anxiety, and I think, as you rightly argue, on our lives, on the quality of our lives?
Well, what happens is it's put out of sight. It goes into subterranean ground. We don't think about it so much. We live much more, perhaps, hedonistically. But things are rumbling underneath, and when certain things begin to develop, like I was saying, say, a serious illness, or we pass on to another stage of life. You know, in your introduction, you talked about children becoming aware of this at a very young age, and then it does go underground, and it does begin to emerge again. It often emerges again during adolescence. Adolescents are very aware of death, death anxiety, and I think the millions of adolescents who flock horror films, for example, I mean, I feel that's behind it. It's a way of taunting death in a way, or desensitizing themselves to it, or their tendency to engage in daredevil acts or life-threatening acts is the same thing. And then, once you reach young adulthood, you then face with the two major tasks of life, really, which is raising a family and developing a career, earning a living, and it goes way underground then until what we think of as the midlife crisis. In the 40s and 50s, and suddenly this begins to emerge again. Children leave home. We begin to be aware of the passage of time. We're beginning to be aware we've reached the summit of life, and we see a long downhill slope ahead of us. And then sometimes death anxiety is never very far from us.
You describe these adolescents dealing with their death anxiety, and it reminds me of the 1991 movie Thelma and Louise. I don't know if you saw it or remember.
Oh, I did, yes.
And that was it. I mean, it's with Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon, and these are two women who are not necessarily repressed, but oppressed. And they go away, they lose control, and they kill all the things that have oppress them or interfere with their lives, including themselves.
Ultimately. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
that sounds
like what you're describing. That's death anxiety.
Right, exactly.
Irvin, let's take a short break.
Okay.
I want to invite some callers to join us. And when we come back, you talk in your book about the awakening experience.
Sure, I'll tell you about that.
Yeah, death, you said, destroys us. but the idea of death can save us, which is really an interesting and provocative statement. We're talking with Irvin Yalom. He's a professor emeritus at Stanford. He's written many books, including the bestseller Love's Executioner. His current book is called Staring at the Sun, Overcoming Terror of Death. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. If you're having anxieties or a loved one is having anxieties, if you want to explore what's the underpinning of that, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
The latest Batman movie is now in theaters. On the next Fresh Air, we meet The Dark Knight star Christian Bale and director Christopher Nolan. Also, Carol Levine on the phases of her marriage, wife, then caregiver, and finally widow. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're joined with Dr. Irvin Yalom. He's a professor emeritus at Stanford University, well known for bringing existential psychotherapy to the forefront. His current book is called Staring at the Sun, Overcoming the Terror of Death. And we'll get your calls in just a minute. But I want to come back, Irvin, to the quoting you before our break, when you said that the fact of death destroys us, but the idea of death saves us. Explain.
Well, I think I can best explain this by telling you about an experience that I had in working with patients who had very, untreatable cancer. You know, I did groups of these patients. This was a long time ago. I did groups are very commonplace now, but then they were a brand new thing, and you know, we didn't quite know what to expect. But one thing that surprised me was that so many people in the group, rather than slump into a kind of numbing despair, did something quite different. They began to live very differently. They said they had grown wiser as a result of their encounter with death. You know, they said they learned to trivialize the trivia of life. They rearranged their priorities. They stopped doing the things they didn't want to do. They said to me, one of them, and I never forgot this because it really changed my whole way of thinking about my work, what a pity it is that we had to wait till now, when our bodies are riddled with death, to learn how to live.
Well, I want to share with you my experience. When I've worked with terminally ill people, there is a point in the process when they just stop fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything opens up, they find peace, and they find clarity.
Mm-hmm.
But when I work with people who have experienced the trauma of cancer, going through cancer treatment,
mm-hmm.
but any trauma that's not necessarily terminal, I have found that people wake up and then go back to sleep.
Right, right.
It's almost like...
Yeah, and the waking up means that you're getting an appreciation of life in a different way. You know, the little things stop mattering to you. One of them told me, well, you know, Dr. Yalom, a cancer cures psychoneurosis. You're not worried about little trivial rejections in life or matters of prestige quite in the same way. You know, in my book I describe maybe the best-known such transformation in literature, and that was in The Christmas Carol with Ebenezer Scrooge. You know, he changed. He changed dramatically in that story, in that Dickens story. In the beginning of the book, mean-spirited and greedy and selfish. And at the end of the book, very magnanimous character that he was much beloved. And what changed him was, you know, existential shock therapy. Dickens had him visited by the angel of the Christmas yet to come, the future, and they dragged him ahead into the future so he could see his own death and nobody caring about it and nobody at his funeral, and that woke him up to that he has this one life and that he should live it very differently.
Irvin, I have to tell you, I had a dear friend of mine come visit me in the office. I don't know if you know, I'm a quadriplegic and have faced death many times. But about a year ago, a dear friend of mine came to my office, and she had just been diagnosed with a glioblastoma, which, for those who don't know, is a terminal brain cancer. There's no real treatment for it.
Right.
So she came into my office right after she was diagnosed, and for the first time she felt safe enough to scream at the top of her lungs, "I don't want to die."
Yeah.
And I said to her, "You know what? Me either."
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "Well, why aren't you freaked out about it like I am?"
Yeah.
And I said, "I really think the only difference between us is I've had more practice."
Right.
So, we do need practice. I don't think left to our own devices, we're going to wake up.
Yeah.
We need an external event and sometimes a repeated one to keep us awake.
That's right. Exactly. I agree with that. We need practice, and we can get used to anything, you know, with enough practice, even to the idea of dying.
Right.
I mean, it's very true in my work. You know, I started to do this kind of work. I developed a lot of anxiety, and so did all my students who were watching my groups or watching my work, in a sense. People got very anxious and upset. I had a full 700-hour therapy, psychoanalysis, when I was a resident. But this many years, 10, 15 years later, I mean, I had not a discussion of death during that whole treatment. And this sent me back into treatment again to start to really deal with that.
And you dealt with somebody who was more existentially oriented.
That's right. I saw it. A psychologist named Rollo May, who in his time was a best-selling author as well. Yeah.
I heard a couple of his keynote speeches.
Yeah, he was a great speaker.
I want to stop hogging your time. We've got a lot of people waiting to join the conversation. And let me give the number out again. It's 888-477-9499. 888-477-9499. We're talking about our anxiety about death. And we've got John on the line, who's got Lyme disease. John?
Would that be me?
That'd be you, yes.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good. I can barely hear you.
You can barely hear me?
Yes.
You have a radio on in the background?
Okay. No, there's nothing. I can hear you better now.
Okay.
I just wanted to, I guess, reiterate one of the points that you've both been tossing back and forth. It really is, I have very, very severe case of Lyme disease. It wasn't diagnosed till I'd had it for, I guess it's approximately 20 or 30 years. And it's really damaged all my major systems. And the prognosis about 6 years ago was that I'd have about 10 more years to go. Now, after I got over being freaked out by that, it has been extremely liberating and allowed me to focus on the things that really are important in my life. My family, and to spend time doing things that will help them and help myself. And I do intend the deadline by a number of years.
Let me just ask you one question, and we're going to have to say goodbye because we got a bad connection. Could you just tell us about the quality of your life these last 6 years?
Have I enjoyed my life?
Yes,
I have, tremendously.
All right.
I had a very rewarding career. I was forced to retire because of the damage, but I found things to take the place of the career that have been more rewarding, but even more rewarding than the hobbies that I've turned into avocations has been the time I've been able to spend with my family.
Well,
and something that the most important thing of all, and one of the things that when you're building your career, you tend to neglect at times.
Right. Well, John, I appreciate your call. I'm going to ask you to listen to Dr. Yalom's comments.
I'll just take them off here
on the radio. But I do appreciate your call, and I wish you great pleasure in the
future. Thank you very much. Same to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, what John is saying is precisely the kind of experience I've had with many other people in that type of situation. I mean, he's one of these people. I don't know why some can take use of it and some can't, but John has the ability, you know, to reprioritize what's important in life. So he's getting satisfaction that he didn't get before out of the really important things of life.
Do you think we need trauma to wake us up?
No, I don't think so. I think there are other ways to do it. I try really hard in my therapy to look at minor things. I mean, look at something like as innocuous as a birthday, you know, especially a big birthday. Somebody's number 40 or 50 or the 50th or 60th birthday. And if you use that as a little bit of leverage to help them look at that, you know, at first we kind of celebrate our birthday, but when you really think about it, it's really just a marker. It's a marker that time is rushing forward, and it's irreversible. It only goes one way. And you can help people get a little bit more serious about their own life. Where are they in life? You know, sometimes you can use little kind of gimmicks or devices. You know, sometimes I'll ask people, draw a line. You know, here's the one end of the line is your birth, one end of the line is your death. Where are you now? Where are you along this life cycle? It's reminding people of that notion.
And I can hear a lot of people in the audience saying, and the benefit of reminding us that death is on our shoulder, as Sartre said, the benefit is
to live differently, to live and treasure the preciousness of the life we have. You know, Richard Dawkins has this wonderful new book out called The God Delusion, and he ends that book. Right towards the end of the book, he has this wonderful metaphor that I really love. I've used it with so many of my patients, and the idea of imagine an immense ruler of time, and there's a laser-thin beam that's going across that ruler of time, and everything that's before it has already lived and died, and everything after it has yet to come to life. And we only have this, in a sense, brief instant when we're in the light, in the sunshine, in a way. And that may help us kind of imagine how precious it is to be alive and to live in a full, generous, you know, avoiding a kind of a mean-spirited sort of life.
That's a lot to ask for people who are younger.
Yeah.
And, you know, I once heard a little girl say, why do so many old people read the Bible? Are they kind of like studying for finals?
Yeah. Well, that's true. But reading the Bible can also, you know, if you look at the major messages of the Bible in terms of, not only in terms of our life cycle, but in terms of loving others as you love yourself. Meaning, you have to love yourself.
Yeah.
You have to try to shed the self contempts and self satisfactions.
I think one of my pet observations is that golden rule about love thy neighbor as thyself. I think that's more descriptive than prescriptive, because I don't think we love ourselves very much these days.
Right.
And we do love our neighbor in the same way we love ourselves. We mistrust them.
When I see patients in therapy, you know, I work a lot at taking a look at what regrets they have about their life and about the way they've been living their life. And people will have a lot of regrets, and some of them tons of regrets. So if you look backwards, you're filled with regrets. But then I try to say, well, let's just turn your face in the other direction. Let's look towards the future. Suppose you and I were meeting again a year from now, 2 years from now. Let's take a look at what new regrets would have been built up during these 2 years. And is there a way that you can change that? Is there a way you can lead a regret-free life?
Yeah,
is there So that's the kind of way I look at this. There's lots of things we don't like about ourselves, but what can we change right now so that we can stop disliking ourselves because we approve of the way we've been living and the way we've been treating ourselves and others?
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Sharon on the line. Sharon, hi. You're on Voices.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a four-year-old son who had some serious realization about death, and I did not know how to deal with it, being agnostic and dealing with my own issues with death. So I was just wondering how you would recommend dealing with that.
Well, before Dr. Yalom answers your question, do you mind telling us a little bit about your issues with dealing with death?
About my... in the background. I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
What are your? You said you have your own issues with dealing with death.
Well, I think I would say that I'm more or less going through an early midlife crisis at 35, and I'm coming to grips with the fact that, you know, life is short. And I feel as though God is everywhere, but that's a hard thing to explain to a four-year-old. So, and I'm working those issues out myself, doing a lot of readings, but, you know, with my children, I don't, as you can hear them, I don't know how to talk to them about that. And they ask me, my four-year-old especially asks a lot. I'll take my answer off the phone because they're screaming, but I'd appreciate any input on that if you could help me.
Of course, of course.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Good luck.
Thank you.
Hey, Irvin, I want you to respond to that question directly, and let me piggyback another question on it for you. Is the goal to necessarily cure death anxiety?
No, the goal, you know, I named my book To Overcoming the Terror of Death. I didn't call it Overcoming the Anxiety of Death, and I did that very deliberately. The publishers wanted to call it Anxiety of Death so it might have bigger sales. But in fact, I don't think we can. I don't think we can overcome anxiety about death because it's just, we're hardwired. It's hardwired into us so that we try to persist as long as we can. But there are some people for whom terror is omnipresent. All their life is lived with thinking, what's the point of doing this or this or this, because we have death facing us all the time. It's these people that I'm really addressing the book to. Your other question about how we talk to children, I can't answer that question. It's a very, very difficult, and parents can't help, even if they're totally agnostic or even atheist, that they can't help but search for some kind of temporary step that will just soothe their children. And so we often find ourselves going into helping develop some kind of illusionary work. Well, don't worry, you know, we'll all be together later on in the afterlife. And that's where a lot of these myths really grew up.
Well,
one of my patients that I was talking to recently said that her mother told her, listen, this is not going to happen for a very, very, very long time, and you won't be worrying about it at that time. And somehow that was reassuring.
My grandson brought it up. My grandson's on the autism spectrum, and when he brought it up, he was 7 years old, and I had been quite ill. And he said to me, "Pop," he said, "how old are you going to be? How old am I going to be when you die?" And it was very uncomfortable asking it. I thought it was a great question.
But
my therapy training taught me how to deal with it, because a good therapist doesn't give answers. We just ask questions. So I said, Sam, so what do you think is going to happen to me when I die? What's going to happen? And he described, you know, a seven-year-old version of heaven. And I said, so what's the problem with me dying? And he said, I won't see you anymore. And I said, well, will you still love me? And he said, well, of course. And I said, well, do you think I'll still love you? And, you know, we had a discussion about love, but it was essentially driven by Sam. And
that's a great response to him. A very good response to him. And I think it probably soothed him a great deal. And even you're saying, well, I'll persist, you know, I'll persist in your memory.
Yeah,
and then you're recalling about our love together is a very good answer.
Yeah, I mean, I knew that part of what I was doing was what Erickson might call a post-hypnotic suggestion. You know, putting my love in his head for him to carry after I was gone.
Right. It sounds like it was there already, though.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Let's go back to the phones, Irvin, before we have to take a break. We've got Erin on the line. Erin?
Hello. Yes, I'm really enjoying the show.
Thank you. Me too.
Well, it just strikes me in this conversation how the function of this anxiety is really to cause people to feel uncomfortable about the lack of meaning in their lives and to try to motivate them to find it and create that. And part of how I've done that and been working on that for myself and trying to bring that into my practice as a young therapist is through bringing mindfulness practices. And I just wanted to kind of see how you feel that this fits in and how Dr. Ogulam feels that this fits in to managing the anxiety and making life more meaningful.
How do you bring it in, Erin?
Depends on the person. For myself, just trying to cultivate a more meaningful relationship with myself and spending time alone, really looking at what I want and how I'm enjoying the moment.
Okay.
I think both things are really important. I think spending time with yourself, meditating upon yourself, trying to find some inner peace is one thing. But the other thing, when you try to establish meaning, of course, as you're saying yourself, you know, you begin to look externally. You know, most ideas about establishing some kind of meaning in life are sort of self-transcendent. They branch off to other people, other causes, other virtues, extending your love to other people, trying to change the world, making it better for others. You know, often these are the kinds of systems of meaning that are very important to us. But, you know, something that you were referring to a little earlier on about, you know, the Buddhist system does try to work with this issue. There's a great many practices about overcoming death, meditations upon death, meditations upon transiency. You know, that's one of the kind of mantras that certain forms of meditation, one point that I had some contact with Vipassana meditation, you're always kind of repeating over and over again, you know, transiency. Everything is transient. And so you kind of get used to this, and you're looking at the true state of things that way, I do believe.
Yeah, and even Irvin, the probably introductory basic mindfulness meditation, you sit there and you observe. You observe your thoughts as they come and go. You observe your emotions as they come and go. And you've had thousands of each one at the end of a half hour. And they just, none of them needs to stay. And that's kind of
And underneath that, too, there's a kind of a meta message, which is the idea of detachment. You're not so attached to each of these ideas. They come, you watch them. Isn't it interesting? Isn't it interesting, in a sense, you're saying to yourself, to see how these thoughts come and play and then leave and go, so you're removing yourself a little bit. Mm. And that's the base of a lot of the approaches to certain kind of inner peace, that things are transient, that you detach yourself from that. That was one of the Buddha's noble truths, that suffering comes from attachment, and we have to learn in some ways to detach yourself.
Well, and one of the things that I have discovered is that this peace that we're all looking for, it doesn't happen when we've won battles. Peace comes when we stop fighting.
Yeah,
And that's the challenge. We're going to have to take a short break and come back. We've got lots of other calls, and there's lots of other issues, including your life and your health and what this book has meant for you. My guest, Dr. Irvin Yalom, Professor Emeritus at Stanford University, is really on the forefront of existential psychotherapy. He's written best-selling books like Love's Executioner, and his current book is called Staring at the Sun, Overcoming Terror of Death. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
You may not know who Verna Griffin is, but you probably know her son, rapper and music producer Dr. Dre. Verna has dealt with domestic violence, among other struggles. But with the support of her family and a belief in herself, she survived and thrived.
Through my life, I've learned to make all my negatives into positives.
I'm Farai Chidea. Verna Griffin's Long Road Out of Compton, next time on News and Notes.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day, you never know who you'll meet at New Jersey's Gunnison Beach.
When you're not wearing clothes, it's a tremendous equalizer.
But the booming popularity of this clothing-optional paradise has a downside.
Publicity brings a lot of gawkers. People want to make my lifestyle their source of entertainment for the day.
Exposure that some can do without.
Get a room.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dr. Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about terror of death and death anxiety with Dr. Irvin Yalom, Professor Emeritus at Stanford University. He's written many books, including best-selling Love's Executioner and When Nietzsche Wept. His current book is called Staring at the Sun, Overcoming the Terror of Death. Irvin, let's go right to the phones. We've got Ellen
sure.
on the line. Ellen? Do we have you?
Ellen?
Go on.
I'm calling in reference to Andrea Collins Smith, who you, Dan, introduced us to.
Yeah, she
was.
Who's
been my best teacher of inspiration how to face death.
Let me give a bit of background, Ellen, if I may. Andrea Collins Smith was first on my show about a year ago, and the day after she was a mother of six, and the day after she graduated Temple University with a degree in social work, she went to her doctor and discovered that she had stage 4 inflammatory breast cancer with a very, very grim prognosis. And she came on the show and she taught us all, she taught the whole Delaware Valley about death, about life, and about dying with grace and living with joy. So that's the background. Go on, Ellen.
What I wanted to say was that I read her her final letter after her death on Punk Rock Mommy, which a lot of us followed on the internet. But I had only read it, joined it at the end, had been going back and reading her entries over the past year. But I will tell you that her final letter actually helped me to manage my feelings about her death.
How so?
Because it's really hard to explain, but she presented herself, as she always has, in such a way that, you know, it was more of an acceptance.
Yeah.
An acceptance that, well, at that point for her, I knew from a couple of the previous notes from her and her husband on the internet that, you know, she was ready because the pain had just gotten so intolerable.
She was tired.
Yes.
And she was a wonderful role model for all of us, for the community. Irvin,
let me say one other thing about that. You know, I have known a lot of people who were desperately ill, facing death, and they managed to imbue the very end of their lives with a great deal of meaning, with the thought that they were modeling for others, for their children, for other of their friends, about how to die and how to face death with, as you put it on the, you on the phone, you know, put it, to face it with grace and with dignity.
Ellen, thanks so much for your call, and she really was a wonderful role model. Irvin, speaking of role models, you were one of the main themes in your book is about the concept of rippling. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I feel that so many ways of kind of dealing with death kind of center on a sense of that we're going to persist. There's not going to be oblivion. There's going to be some form of afterlife. We're going to get famous, or we're going to be always remembered. And you know, these things, of course, after generations, really don't happen. But you know, I feel that there is one thing that we should be looking at, which is the idea, I call it rippling, just as you throw a pebble into into a pond, and there's these ripples that come out, and they get smaller and smaller and go further and further until they're just minute nano ripples. But I think the same thing is true for what we do to others. You know, we pass something on of ourselves to others, some trait, some piece of learning, some act of virtue to others, and that changes their life, and they pass it on to others and to others and to others, and that gives many of us a great sense of satisfaction.
You know,
some people, it's very obvious. You know, if you're teachers or if you're a therapist or a physician, you know, it's very clear. Sometimes you work with the children of these people and you see what's been passed on to the children that in some way, some small way, you played a part in. That's what I mean by rippling.
You know, there was a study done years ago at Harvard. They've got a project where they study centenarians, and one of the things these centenarians had in common was that they all had a generous spirit.
Yeah.
So the kind of people that would say, come here, sit, tell me about your life. Tell me how you are. Tell me how it's going. And they really want to know. And they were the kind of people that attracted people, having a generous spirit.
Yes.
You know, and when you think about it, I mean, you talk about the theme in the Bible. One of the themes in all Bibles is, you know, feed the hungry. It's just that simple. You do you do that, and you'll be probably much happier with your life.
Well, you begin to feel some pride in yourself. If you want to love yourself, you have to do things in which you can take some pride.
Yeah, as opposed to the self-esteem movement that started in your beloved California about 30 years ago, where we told children they were wonderful just because they were.
Right.
Yeah. Didn't work out very well.
Yeah.
Let's go to Virginia.
Hello.
Hi, Virginia. You there?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a first-time caller.
Well, thank you.
A little nervous, I guess, but...
I'll hold your hand.
I'm really interested in the topic today. I have some thoughts. I was thinking about the timing and reckoning with this terror of death in some way. It would seem to me that some socioeconomic factors may very well come into play here.
Yeah.
Now, I'm thinking in terms of how the poor and slash and possibly oppressed people might handle this terror.
Well, I think you raise a really interesting question. Irvin, any thoughts?
Well, you know, this goes really back to the thoughts of an old psychologist, very well known in my field, named Maslow. You know, who had this sort of what he called hierarchy of needs. When we have really overwhelming kind of economic needs and needs for shelter and food, well, these are the things that really absorb our attention. When all these other needs gradually begin to be satisfied, then we get to these deeper layer of needs, of existential, more humanistic kinds of concerns and needs. So I think that that point is well taken. But at the same time, there are going to be times when people in the most wretched situations are going to be faced with horrible situations or horrible losses when they're going to be worried about the exact same issues.
Virginia, thanks so much for your call. So, Irvin, in the words of my first supervisor and mentor,
yes.
So new, how are you?
Well, I'm right now. I deal with these issues quite a bit in my life because I'm in good health, but I'm 77 years old, and once you get to be that age, you know, issues of time passing, the irrevocable march of time are never far away. This book has been interesting to me. I have a personal memoir section in this book because I think any time a psychologist writes, you all are a philosopher writes, you also have to know that the autobiography of that person is an important part of his writing, determines what it is he thinks and what it is he feels. So I have a autobiography about some of my own experiences and awareness of death as well.
Unfortunately, we're not going to have time to review it, but I wish I did because it was really fascinating. I highly recommend it. So tell me, what's it like for you with your future so short and your history so long?
Well, you know, I'm in a very good phase of life. Well, another one of the points that I try to make in this book that I think that a death terror, a strong terror about death, is very much related to a sense of unlived life. You mm-hmm. fear the end of life much more if you felt that you haven't really lived it well. And that's one thing where I feel is, that's not true for me. I feel like I've done what I wanted to do in life. I feel very good about my profession. It's been a calling for me. And I feel good about my expressing myself as a writer. I've written all my life. I love to write. And, you know, I've done much better than I could ever have expected to do. So that part of it feels fine for me.
I want to ask you a theoretical question. You mm-hmm. talked about death anxiety being worse when you feel you've lived an unfulfilled life. I wonder if the opposite is true. I wonder if living an unfulfilled life is about death anxiety.
Hmm. Well, it's hard to know which comes first, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I think people, you know, this old philosopher I talked about, Epicurus, he said 2,500 years ago that people who are overly concerned about death anxiety will do anything to try and make it go away. They try to get richer. They seek fame. They try to scratch their names on the tablets of immortality by having buildings named after them. They're restless. They can never be at peace because they have to keep moving ahead of death. So that kind of confirms the kind of thing you just said. Yeah.
Yeah.
If it's too much for us, we have to keep moving in some way. We can't find any empathy.
And that's the good news and bad news about having a mind.
That's right. Exactly. It's a precious gift, but it also is a source of a lot of anxiety.
Like most. Irvin, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been delightful.
It's been interesting talking to you, Dan.
My guest today has been world-renowned psychiatrist, author, Dr. Irvin Yalom. His new book is called Staring at the Sun, Overcoming Terror of Death. He's also the author of many other books, including Love's Executioner and When Nietzsche Wept. Well, if you want to reach us or have a show idea, we're at voices@whyy.org/... Or we're also at... You can reach me, I'll get that right, Dr. Dan Gottlieb at AOL.com. The engineer for today's show has been Bob Purdick. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Voices in the Family is co-produced by Gita Simons and Elisa Walters. Gita directed today's show. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends. Day to day.